I would like to, if you would sort of review, and you have told me once before, but it's been so long, about your own personal history and where it was that you grew up in Coachella?
Yeah, more or less. Oh, I don't know. Let's see. I don't know. There's a guy named Dick Tracy, you know, so let me tell you about him. We came to California in 1947 because my father was a Methodist minister and a school teacher who always sort of aspired to the worst possible positions. And he had a hard time in Oklahoma, always passing through the school board. And we moved to Thermal. And there was no Methodist church nearby, so I was enrolled as a Presbyterian. I was baptized as a Presbyterian. And in Coachella Presbyterian Church, the minister there was an ex-migrant minister by the name of Harvey Harper, who had a very strong impact on me. And Harvey Harper had been in the migrant ministry not too many years before he came to Coachella. In fact, I think he probably came to Coachella sort of out of his interest in farm workers. And he went to Occidental College, so I went to Occidental College. It was sort of a circuitous route. I went to Whitworth College for one semester and found out the college was easier than I thought it was. Then I thought, well, I can go to Occidental because I'd heard it was hard and I didn't have much confidence that I could do it. So I said, I'll try this easy school first if I can do that without transfer. So that was in 1955 I started college. Finished in 1959. And went to one semester at McCormick Theological Seminary. And at the end of that semester, kind of did the same thing I'd done with college. I said, well, this is kind of easy. I'll go someplace I hear is harder. And so I went to Union Seminary. And I was there from my wife, Susan, was pregnant shortly after we got there, so we kind of hurried things up and finished seminary by going all summer and then the fall semester. And I finished in the fall of 19... I finished whatever the date was, around January 1st, 1962. And we had one son, Matthew, who was about a month old when I finished seminary. We came back to California and in those years, it was just sort of the awakening of, I think there were freedom rides going on. But I was raised in a very sort of conservative mold politically, although very sort of pietistically concerned about charity and about the individual needs of people. No concept of organization, any relationship to unions or anything like that. I was also very, very Protestant. I voted for Nixon over against Kennedy because Kennedy was a Catholic. But there was all this kind of unrest going on. And I remember in those years, one of the big things that was of interest to all of us was what we call a priest-worker relationship for clergy. And that had a strong impact on my own thinking. There's a fellow by the name of Phil Farnham. He lived across the hall from us. And Phil was also very interested in that sort of worker priest or priest worker approach to things. And I had always worked outdoors and done manual labor to put myself through college and seminary. I liked the idea of working outdoors. And I like the idea of manual labor. So when I went to California out of seminary, I was looking for some situation in which I could have a job, a laboring job, and also be a minister. And that was in January and February. For a while, I looked. I sort of looked. That didn't look too possible. And I was looking at more traditional ministries. And of course, the Presbyterian Church was not looking for anybody that had been in seminary in New York City. They weren't too interested in me. We were getting hungry and weren't getting very far. We were living in Susan's parents' cabin up in Yosemite, which was a nice deal. I was in touch with Warren Oast because I had spent a summer in the Ministry of National Parks. And he had two options for us. One was to go to the Virgin Islands and work as a sort of park ranger in the ministry. Or to work in Sequoia National Park half the year and the other half in Zion National Park. And I would probably be a garbage collector or something for the state and have this ministry on the site. I was almost ready to take that when, kind of out of the blue, Chris Hartmire called, and he found us up there in the mountains. And, he asked if I wanted to, they heard about me from Phil Farnham. They had some relationship in New York where Chris was working for the East Harlem Protestant Parish, and Phil knew, I did not know Chris in New York. And I said, yeah, I'll come down to Goshen. And Mary McFarland was, I think, the Kings County Migrant Ministry Director. Sue Carhart was over in Corcoran, just about ready to get tarred and feathered. And I met with Mary McFarland and Chris Hartmire in some little drive-in in Goshen. And it took me about half an hour to decide that's what I wanted to do. And I said, well, you know, you don't know me and I don't know you, but I think that's what I want to do. In the meantime, my parents had moved to Tulare, which was 10 miles from Goshen. I had relatives in Visalia. My brother-in-law was a captain in the highway patrol, and my other relatives were like assistant superintendent of schools, so they were kind of establishment people in Tulare County. And really, without seeing it, I took without Susan seeing the place, I took that job, and we were real happy to have worked. After about a week, I think I started there around mid March or 1st of April or something like that, 1962. And after about a week, Chris, who had been spending time over in Oxnard with Caesar, said, look, Caesar is moving to Delano. He's going to take a month's vacation. He can't stand it. He's just going to take a week. And he's moving his family to Delano, and Richard has found a place for him. And I want you to spend the next month just running with him to see what he's up to, and see if it's something that we might be interested in. And Caesar had, I think, about $800 in savings, and he was living on that, and Helen was working in the fields a little bit, and Caesar was getting ready to work in the fields a little bit, and they were just sort of hanging on by the skin of their teeth. So I had a migrant ministry credit card and a little car that got good mileage, and so I just kind of put it at his service, and I just went everywhere he went. And I watched the guy, and I knew he was nuts, because he was... You know, he was going to do this big thing. He kept talking about it. I was not much help because I didn't speak very good Spanish. And my main contribution was my car and my credit card and an old mimeograph machine. But I was sort of fascinated by it. Meantime, I went down. I have to tell you also that that project in Goshen, the United Church of Christ project, and I got very interested in the UCC. I had never thought very much about it, that maybe I'd be a UCC minister. But I drove down, I think in the summer, and I went down and met with my presbytery in Riverside County. And I forget who the moderator or state clerk was, I forget what happened, but they had a little meeting there, and they found out that I was going to work with a migrant ministry. And they said that did not qualify as a, that the kind of thing I was going to be doing did not qualify as a calling. It was not a call by a congregation. And they looked a little askance at the migrant ministry and the UCC, that combination did not give them very much enthusiasm for what I was going to do. And I was kind of shocked because all this time I was thinking about being a sort of a worker priest, and I thought that that was going to qualify. And I was just sort of dumbfounded. I really hurt and angry. So angry that I just immediately went to Walter Press and said, you know, screw them, I'm just going to be a UCC minister. You guys had me. And they snatched me up and I said, yeah, ordained you. So I was ordained at, in December of that year. I had to go through some study and sort of prove that I knew what congregational polity was as opposed to Presbyterian polity. Something's never been relevant since, but it took me about 4 or 5 months. In December, I was ordained by Cleo Strohmeyer and Walter Press. Reverend Cleo Strohmeyer was the minister of the United Church of Christ in the Congregational Church in Tulare. And then we went about trying to build some kind of a project in Goshen. That went on.
And would you just explain about how, now at that point, UCCs were paying your salary. You were on the conference payroll?
Mm-hmm. I think half the money came from the Board for Home and Ministries or something. There was a commission on church and town and country, or Shirley Green. I only met once, I think, there, but my relationship was always Walter Press. I think the money was split between national money and conference money.
And that was a denominational contribution then to the California Migrant Ministry to pay your
salary? No, it wasn't. I was paid by the United Church of Christ at that time, if I remember right.
So were,
that may have changed.
So were you considered CMM staff at that point?
Yes, I was supervised by the California Migrant Ministry, but I think it was a relationship that had never happened before for either one of them. And for the United Church of Christ, what they were really saying was, we don't want to, we're, for the first time in California, we're not going to give the money to the migrant ministry to go out and give Bibles and Sunday school classes under the trees. We're not going to have anything against that, but we want to try something experimental here in terms of community development. And I quickly ran to the library and tried to find books on community development, seeing what I was just hired to do. You know, I didn't have the slightest idea. Read some kind of silly stuff, you know, that sort of related to the United Nations, what their concept of community development. Mary McFarland was very helpful, and Sue Carhart. Sue Carhart was I don't know if you ever met her.
I have.
I mean, she was an activist. She was not a community developer. And I had all this sort of smorgasbord of approaches laid out, because Mary McFarland was interested in kids. There was somebody else, and there was another person working around there, I forget her name, but she was very involved with kids in Goshen.
I remember that person. I think she was on staff when we were there.
Sandy. So there were kids, and then there was this kind of activism, political activism in Corcoran that Sue Carhart was in, and then there was the farm workers organizing effort that Caesar was doing. And then there was Mary McFarland, who was kind of really interested in adult education and eventually became an educator. And I couldn't figure any of it out. Right? So I said, well, I'm just going to just muck around here in Goshen for a while. If I can have your permission, I'll just sort of get to know people. I met some very interesting people there. I think most people I knew are dead now, but E.W. Bobo, who is a retired tramp, he was a from Arkansas, and Goshen just sort of attracted people who just hung out, either farm workers that just were trying to get down roots, make roots, or people that are almost bums. And E.W. Bobo was kind of this delightful bum that everybody sort of took care of. But he was an engineer, or a draftsman at least. And I got a kick out of him. He was always half drunk. He was just, he had all these ideas about that. Like he was going to organize the Goshen Chamber of Commerce. Kind of like organizing a Chamber of Commerce in Ethiopia or something. It didn't make any sense. A guy by the name of Don Halstead, a farmer, had 40 acres, was trying desperately to stay alive. Not particularly a religious guy, but just a real good heart guy, who Mary, I think, had found. He died recently. And he was willing to be on this sort of advisory board that we were putting together. And then there was a junkyard dealer there, Monte Vasquez, who was Alfredo Vasquez's brother, kind of the dark side of the family. I've been much better off when I started with Alfredo than I started with Mother, because he was just had a junkyard and Alfredo was a farm owner, so he knew a bit more. there were some other family. Now, an important thing happened there that kind of all goes in this. And there was a guy by the name of Howard Washburn. I don't know if you've ever heard that name. But Bard McAllister, the American Friends Service Committee, had hired Howard Washburn to start a self-help housing project. And it was the first project. And so it was, Goshen was kind of this experimental place for all things going on. And their self-help housing project of the American Friends Service Committee kind of got confused with us, and we kind of got confused with them. And whenever I'd find a family that that I thought had potential of sort of some stability that they might want to build a house, I'd turn them over to Howard, and Howard would turn his contacts over to me. And we cooperated a lot. I don't know, is this too much detail? Walter Press would come down, and he was very, very, he just had a lot of compassion. He understood I was young, and I was 23, I think. And I was trying to figure all this stuff, maybe 24, I was trying to figure all this stuff out, and it was completely new to me. I remember I just voted for Nixon, and all of a sudden I was getting exposed to all this other approach to things, and I was hanging out with Catholics and trying to figure all this out. And anyway, we ended up starting a community center. I thought we needed some project for everybody to work on. Sort of rush to get out of activism into tasks. And so we got very task-oriented in building this community center. And as soon as it was built, I said, oh, this is a mistake. Now I'm going to be a youth director in this community center, and I got to get the heck out of this. Meantime, I was trying to set up little house meetings for Manuel Chavez, who was running around trying to sell memberships to this new organization, National Farm Workers Association. And not very many people in Goshen were interested in that. And I was no help in that at all, because that was one of the reasons I got involved in TASC, because that looked like absolute, you know, dream world that they'd ever organize a statewide organization. I certainly didn't have time for that kind of dream. But after I got deeply into the task, business, then I realized I'd made a mistake. And I wanted to kind of, it looked a lot more interesting to me, the stuff that the Caesar was doing. Now, I also had some experiences that really were profound to me at that time. That was dealing with the County Board of Supervisors. We were trying to get some street lights and some streets paved. And I would go in and sort of stand in front of the County Board of Supervisors, and they would kind of mutter and scoff and laugh, and you know, I'd go back, and I couldn't understand why nothing was happening. And I was just beginning to experience powerlessness from the Goshen point of view. And I was easily intimidated in those days by that. You know, I mean, just I did not want to stand in front of the Board of Supervisors anymore if I wasn't going to win, because I just did not like the idea of people snickering about people in Goshen. So about the middle of 63, I think it is, Gilbert Padilla was through in some organizing project with CSO down in San Bernardino, I believe, and he was kind of knocking around, and his home was in Hanford, and Chris had some money that he got from some foundation and hired Gilbert. And meanwhile, David Havens had moved to the area, and David had taken over Mary McFarland's job, and they put together a Kings to Larry Migrant Ministry instead of just Kings County, where it was. And David was sort of a closet to a radical. He was the kind of guy that just one morning got up out of bed at his class and didn't go to class, got on a plane and flew to Cuba because he'd heard that this guy Castro had just marched into Havana, went down, took pictures of Castro, and, you know, he would just do things, snap of the finger, he'd do these things. And, you know, David's craziness sort of began to rub off on me. And then Gilbert's just absolute sort of gut instinct for poor people was very important. And so David and Gilbert and I started conniving how we were going to convince Chris that we should not be involved in this project, and who could we con into taking it over so that I could get out of there and we could go do some of this exciting stuff. And fortunately, there was Phil Farnham came along just the right time, and he was right out of Union Seminary, and he took over the project in Goshen, took over my house, took over everything so that I could get the heck out of there. And this probably was about 63 now. Toward the end of 63, Gilbert and I opened a little tiny office, two-room office in Porterville. And by this time, El Malcriado was being printed, so there was something that we could show people. And there was the insurance program that Caesar had started, death benefit insurance. You buy retread tires through their co-op and motor oil and other stuff. So Gilbert and I started the Farm Workers Organization, FWO, in Porterville, toward the end of 63, I believe. And I changed my membership to Porterville Congregational Church. Minister there by the name of Jim Hazen, whose lives we immediately began to we just turned his life upside down in a period of about 6 months, because the first thing that Gilbert got into was in those days there was a guaranteed minimum wage for sugar beet workers, because sugar was subsidized, federally subsidized. So it was a federal minimum wage. I think you had to pay $1.40 an hour. And no sugar beet workers were making $1.40 an hour. They're being paid by the piece rate, and since many of the kids were working on the adults' social security cards, it looked like there'd be 40 people working in the field back to the 80. And when you actually divided the 40 into the amount of money that was paid, it came out to $1.40. But in fact, they were making about 70 cents an hour because there was two people hoeing that row. And there was a good guy, I remember his name real well, I don't remember his first name, but there was a enforcement officer by the name of Reed who would hold hearings, and Gilbert and I would go out and find these folks that were getting cheated. They all lived in the Woodville labor camp. And the first case that he came up with, I think it was about 80 employees working for some contractor in the Porterville area. My God, it didn't turn out that the first case was that of a grower who was one of the top dogs at First Congregational Church of Porterville. And we dragged him into court and everything. I don't remember his name, but the music hit the violin real fast. It was just didn't take 48 hours before Walter was getting calls. You know, get these guys out of here. You know, they're not even in the AFL-CIO. This isn't even a legitimate organization. I mean, it's bad enough we got AWOC running around here, because AWOC had an office over in Strathmore or someplace like that, Lindsay. And they were agitating. A woman by the name of Violet Rotan was running the office. And she was a Okie, just a born agitator. And she was getting all the Okies stirred up around her.
Was that the AWOC office?
Yeah. And so all of a sudden you've got sort of seizures, this weird thing showing up in the barrios, this El Mal Criado newspaper, and then you got Violet Rotan, and then out of nowhere here's the church getting involved in things too. And an ordained minister. And I remember that I was being very radical. I would be invited to, you know, since I was an ordained minister, I'd get invited to fill a pulpit on a Sunday and never get invited back again. I was just obnoxious. And Gilbert and I started a little co-op. I put the co-op together, and Gilbert went out and found all these cases in the fields. And the co-op was a gasoline co-op. And I thought our co-op was better than Caesar's, because you know, you need a set of tires maybe once every 3 or 4 months, those old retreads, and people would come back to, but here they had to come every day to fill up the gas. And I thought we really had them hooked in a better way, and I was trying to sell this idea to Caesar's, but they got to open a gas station. About 3 years later they did, and it was just a bomb. You know, it was horrible. But we got about 100 families to join our organization. Now, something else happened in 63, late 63, maybe early 64, and that was a wrench strike at the Nell labor camp. And David and I organized that. And almost all the people that organized that wrench strike were people who had filed grievances on the sugar beet business. And living over at that was at the Woodville labor camp, and the O'Neill was the one over near Visalia. And living in the O'Neill labor camp were some summer volunteers for the American Friends Service Committee, Gabe and Doug. You know, he was with their union for years, Doug. He lives in Coachella Valley now. Anyway, probably a Berkeley student or something like that. And I think it was in the spring of, or winter of 63-64, that the housing authority of Larry County raised the rents on these tin shacks that they had condemned. First they condemned them, then they raised the rent. They raised it from $18 to $22 a month for these tin shacks that Eleanor Roosevelt had dedicated back in 1935 or something. And, I mean, it didn't take any organizing, just spontaneous combustion. People, they just didn't know what to do, and so we set up a bank account. People paid their rent into the bank account, or at least alleged that they did. Most of them just didn't pay their rent and split when they were ready to follow the props. Actually, what happened. And then we were really into it with the county government and the county board of supervisors. And I think for the church, something happened there, and that was there was a lot of pressure on Dr. Norberg and Reverend Press. But it was important because by this time, it's a good thing I'm leaving the Rio Grande Valley because I'm not known for all this. This book. Relationship to the farm workers union. We're trying to get middle class people involved. What I was going to say is I was writing editorials for the Mal Criado, and I wrote an editorial about blacks in the South, and it was about the time of Selma. What year was Selma? Oh wait, it was. They just had a 20-year celebration, so.
So it must have been 65.
Okay, so this is Birmingham. Stuff was going on anyway, and I was writing editorials about the blacks and how the church was out front in all this, and stuff was going on in the Bay Area, and you could just feel the state of California was just about to levitate, you know, and you just knew that something was about to happen. But nobody expected the most radical thing to happen in Tulare County. Poor people stopping paying their rent, church in the middle of it. Anyway, there was a march from the Linnell labor camp to the county courthouse.
Yeah, I was there.
Okay. And the most significant thing about that march, I think, was that Brother, what was his name? His real name was Leroy Chatfield.
I've forgotten what his religious name is.
Anyway, Brother so-and-so, a vice principal from Bakersfield, came up and marched with his collar on at the front of the march. And this is in the diocese where Bishop Willinger was still alive and kicking, about 87 years old, who was just, you know, a personal friend of all the major growers of the diocese, all tied up with, I mean, just no friend of the farm workers at all. And here was Leroy out in front with his collar on. And it just caused all kinds of havoc. A lot of people think that the first strike that took place was the Rose strike. But I think historically it was the J.D. Martin strike. Or was it? Well, I guess there was the Rose strike. Anyway, if you go back over all that chronology, there was a strike in the Roses. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
The Butters and the Grafters. Mm-hmm. And Caesar decided to experiment, and we didn't put up any picket lines or anything. And we kept the workers out of there for about 10 days. The only thing that's important about that is, from the point of view of the church, was that I asked Walter Press, I said, look, I'm going to take some vacation time, and I'm going to go up and work with those folks. And he said, no, it's all right. You don't have to take any vacation. And I don't know if he checked it with Dick Norberg or what.
Yeah, I got that story from both of them, and they both talked about the significance of that decision, especially Dick talked about the significance of that.
Yeah.
And then, as he put it, sometimes big doors swing on small hinges.
Yeah, right. Because that became a real issue. all this time, if you could ever find Jim Hazen, I don't know if he's alive or sane or anything anymore. I mean, he kind of went off the deep end of it. But Jim Hazen was meeting with the growers there in Porterville, because that was sort of the focus of all the antagonism. And Walter would come down once a month and meet with growers there, and he was trying to stave them off and listen to them.
See, Jim Hazen was...
He was the minister.
The minister at Porterville Church.
First Congregational Church. And he was just a real nice guy caught in the middle of all this all of a sudden. It was just kind of the last thing you ever expected when you went out there and to the boondocks and all this started happening. But anyway, after the Rose Grafter strike, then there was a strike at the J.D. Martin Ranch, and that was a table break. They were thinning, I think, or it was after the pruning, so it was in the spring of 64. And that strike went on for several months, and we tried picket signs. That's the first time we ever made a sign that said, Huelga. I didn't know what the heck that was. And of course, we lost that strike real fast. But I remember a meeting about July or so after that strike had been lost. This is 65 now. This is just before the grape strike. So the J.D. Martin strike was 65.
Okay.
All these strikes were going on in 65. The roses. In the spring, and then the summer was J.D. Martin. Anyway, there was a meeting at the headquarters of the Farm Workers Union, and there was a vote, there'll be no more strikes. 3 years, no more strikes.
and how ironic.
Right. In the meantime, Larry Itmel was leading grape strikes in Coachella Valley, and then he moved his grape strike up to Arlen, Lamont. He was in jail in Coachella, and he was in jail in Arlen-Lamont. And there was this sort of ominous sign that the AFL-CIO was being more radical than the NFWA. And you could just, it's like they sort of took this vote that there won't be any strikes while the strike was going on in Lamont. Just sort of whispering in the dark that, you know, if we say this way, you know, maybe it'll just pass over us and go up to Visalia or something. But instead, Larry brought the strike to Delano on September 16th, 1965. It was a big meeting on Sunday at Aurelio Guadalupe. And, well, the NFWA membership, there's probably 1,000 there, but we called it 3,000. Filled up the gymnasium of the church. And they voted not to strike.
Hello? Yeah, just a sec.
Hi. Just come across the courtyard here, the asphalt courtyard. Okay. About a month before the grape strike started. At that time, we still had the organization in Porterville voted in the winter of 64 and 65 to merge with the National Farm Workers Association. Which didn't mean much because we only had about 100 families. But what it really meant was that Gilbert and I felt that we could openly associate with the National Farm Workers Association, and that it would not be the end of the money, that the church would still, it would favor that. So when when the strike started in Delano in September of 65, I was driving back and forth every day from Porterville to Delano. And sometimes I'd stay overnight there. And I would say that other than Chris Hartmeyer and a very small handful, there was not very much church attention or input into that strike. I know that Chris probably would tell you this story about the handful of clergy that went out and got arrested for shouting welder. Remember that?
Chuck McLean was one of
Chuck
them.
Chuck McLean, yeah. And that was like a... you know, what clergy have been doing in the South for 5 years. But it was kind of like a radical action, in at least in the Valley and for most of California. And I would say that sort of opened the door, got the attention that the church had had a ministry there. And really started a major debate. Have you talked to Jean Boutillier?
No.
You know, Jean got... See, Jean was coming down to the strike. He was an associate pastor at First Congregational Church in Fresno during this time. And he was driving down to the strike occasionally and being on picket lines. He got fired for that. And suddenly he and Luana were without a job. It was just a very, very controversial time.
He's UCC too, isn't he?
Yeah. That was probably within the first 2 or 3 months of the strike. And Gene probably more than anybody, Gene probably suffered from the church's involvement more than anybody, because that First Congregational Church was very conservative, and he was just thrown out on the streets. I have to tell you more of the circumstances. We kind of all took it for granted that was going to happen. So I never even talked to him about much, but I know that that was very important. David Havens was photographed and arrested for reading me the definition of a scab on the back of a pickup.
I remember that.
And when these clergy began to identify themselves as clergy types, doing these things and getting arrested. Still no Catholics to speak of. Leroy was helpful raising money and things, but he was not able to be out front in those sort of days. But the big turning point came when, the month before Easter of 66, when this march to Sacramento took place. And I believe Bishop Willinger also was retired, and I believe Bishop Manning came from Stockton, where he was something of a liberal up there. I believe that's when he came to Fresno. And when we got to Fresno, the doors of the Catholic churches began to open up to us on that march, and the Franciscans began to be open. Father Mark Day was moved to the Franciscans, I believe. I believe he was a Franciscan. He took over Our Lady of Guadalupe in Delano sometime in 66. Whenever it was, shortly after Manning moved to Fresno. That was very symbolic, because that kind of gave us a pastor in the city. And Mark, although I don't think he had any real justification for that. He never needed much, but he would talk of himself as being the striker's priest. And the Franciscans in general started to open up. Probably around late 66 in January. I can't remember his name, Father Alan McCoy?
McCoy.
He came a few years after that, I think. I don't know where he was and all that, but he knows that history.
I got to meet with him the first week in April.
But there's very little I can tell you about all that stuff going on because I was, you know, just picket lines and stuff like that from day to day. So I don't really know too much of what the politics of the church was. I just know that I was protected, you know, by Norberg and press. So I never had to worry very much. And Chris. It never bothered me very much.
Do you know that Leroy said you were the first Protestant clergyman he ever knew?
Oh, is that right? Yeah, that's funny. It's really funny because some of us Protestants had more protection than the Catholics did. It wasn't until the bishops decided they were going to go with this that the Catholics were, the priests were free to do anything. Just the opposite in the valley now, where I work. The Protestants are terrified to have anything to do with me, and the Catholics are wide open. I mean, they got all kinds of protection. So it's all reversed now. The Protestants are the timid ones in our society. And in the 60s, the Catholics were the timid ones. It's Catholic bishops and Catholic priests who take, in the 80s, are taking all the leadership. There's no more National Council of Churches to speak of. There's very little evidence of middle class Protestant participation and cutting edges of things. And I don't want to, you know, I mean, there's Fife in Tucson, there's things happening, but, you know, American Catholic bishops that are writing a letter on the economy and challenging the unbridled capitalism, kind of stuff that the National Council and UCC and the Presbyterians and Methodists used to do in the 60s and early 70s. It's almost entirely reversed itself now. Dominant leadership in the church today is in the Catholic Church for social concerns. That's my perception of it. It's one other thing that happened. Oh, I know. It was the debate that took place within the Farm Workers Union on the night before they started the march to Sacramento over whether or not the Virgin of Guadalupe would lead the march. Remember that?
What was the meaning of that debate?
Whether or not you could mix really religious symbolism with the working class movement. Epifanio Camacho was a Pentecost or Seventh-day Adventist or something, and he was elected to lead the march. And being a non-Catholic, he argued strongly against having the Virgin out in front of the march. And of course, he was voted down because he was like one Protestant and one non-Catholic out of everybody else. And I remember, since he didn't agree with it, why, if I remember right, he was voted out as the leader of the march. And one of the Vasquez, Mike Vasquez, one of those Vasquez brothers, was elected as the marshal, the march leader. Carry the Virgin, and you know, it was a very shrewd move on the part of Caesar because it leveraged open all kinds of Catholic doors up the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out the Catholics would, I never knew whether they were doing it for the Virgin or they were doing it for the martyrs, but they put all this food out when they'd march into a town. And it was sick. The theme was peregrinación, pilgrimage.
Yes, penitence.
Penitence, you know, and it took on a very strong religious overtone then. And, you know, a lot of the thinking that went on in that was just to pry open the doors of the Catholic Church. How can you reject these pilgrims?
With the Virgin leading.
That's right. So, you know, it just kind of blew the doors open. We'd march into a town, and whether the priest liked it or not, the people of the working class people of the church were there with the doors open. And Mankiw just walked right over the priest. You know, there is a there's a strategy which is always to operate within the experience of your people and outside the experience of your opponents. And the opponents could never understand that strategy. And it confounded the Marxists to the left and the farmers to the right. They could never understand what that Virgin had to do with this whole thing. All it did was bring in $1 million. That's all it did.
Right in the middle of the experience of the people that right. that were being organized.
They understood it.
What do you think their understanding of that was?
That that this was a movement in keeping with Mexican revolutionary tradition on one hand. Throwing the Spaniards out, throwing the French out. This was also that it was led by someone who had deep respect for the symbolism of the fathers and the mothers and the ancestors, a lot of respect for that tradition. And it was for the more either mystical or believed in magic, it was just guaranteed success.
How can you lose with a virgin on your side?
10,000 people with a virgin on your side, you just sit down on the money. But now, you know, from looking back on it 20 years later, what it really is it was grounding the movement in the system of values that the farm workers had inherited. It was really religious jujitsu, because all the stuff that the Spaniards had taught the Indians to keep them in line was now being used against them. Same thing that the slaves did. I mean, you should never have taught them this, the Exodus story, right? You should never have given them this virgin, because, you know, pacified them for a number of centuries, but all of a sudden she became revolutionary. And the virgin said, march and fight, why didn't you march and fight?
She was whispering in Caesar's ear.
There's one little incident that I can't remember his name. I think part of his name is Russell. That's us. I don't know. He was the executive of the National Council of Churches. And very early in the strike, we were trying to get the National Council of Churches to endorse the Great Boycott. Have you looked at that? Okay, Chris can tell you about that. There's a lot of politics going on, trying to get them to endorse it. And tremendous pressure against it. And, you know, we were so fanatical, single-minded and closed-minded that we could not understand other people's political problems. Everybody's tradition and history had to shape itself to our mold. And this man, some dear man, sent me this citation awarding me as the first Protestant clergy to engage in this very close hand-to-hand combat with the enemy, and being so beloved of the workers. I mean, where does it come from? All this stuff in this letter, in this citation. And I remember being in that little office and opening my mail, that little office on Albany or wherever it was, and pulling this thing out. And there's a bunch of other people in there. They all go, "Oh, that's great. What is that?" "Wow, boy, you know, they really respect that." I said, "Yeah, but they haven't endorsed the great boycott." So I took a heavy marker and I wrote across it. I said, "Obviously, you hold me in some esteem, for which I do not hold you." And I signed my name and sent it back to him. I mean, that kind of, you know, sort of stupid, narrow-minded self-righteousness, you know, was also tied up in all this. I mean, David Havens was just, he was always getting in trouble by being vulgar, and there's just a lot of what was going on was trying to sort of impulsively push up against the limits and try to push beyond the limits, and try to, what we now call forcing the other side to react. Mm-hmm. And we were just always engaged in this sort of impetuous action, trying to get these reactions. Well, the reaction I got was they thought I must be crazy back in New York. It took me about 5 years before I could ever get in their door again after sending in that thing. there was a lot of stupidity going on.
Well, some of that because some of you had really bad experiences with the church, felt a lot of rejection.
I think it happened to me because, I had a very bad experience in Coachella Valley. I believe it was in 1967, maybe 68, we went down to Coachella Valley and we struck in the grapes down there. And some of those growers we struck used to be my Sunday school teachers. I mean, it was probably a more personal experience for me than it was for anybody in that year. A fellow by the name of Ben Laughlin owns Laughlin Bay Shop. I remember Ben coming out on the picket line and seeing me. He said, "My God, Jim, is that you?" Of course, he didn't say, "My God," because he was my Sunday school teacher, back in the fourth and fifth grade. He says, "Is that you, Jim Drake?" I said, "Yes." "Is that you, Ben Laughlin?" And he says, "Yes." I said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Ben, I know that you own some grapes, and I know that you used to be my Sunday school teacher, and I remember very clearly, I didn't, you know, I was making all this up. I remember very clearly that you taught us Amos, and Jeremiah, and Hosea, and all those other little kids were sleeping, but I was listening." And I said, "I'll come back to haunt you." But anyway, they got so bitter about the church's participation and my participation that the First Presbyterian Church there in Coachella had given me this interpreter's Bible, you know, like 30 volumes, mm-hmm. the whole set. Which in these days, today, probably cost $2,000. In those days, it cost about $350. And they wanted it back. And they were just just offended by the fact that that one of theirs could be with this motley commie bunch, you know. And that was my first experience of red baiting, and that kind of absolute rejection by people that I grew up with, even my very best friend, a guy that I, you know, a very poor kid. I won't mention his name, but he and I grew up as next-door neighbors in Thermal, and were inseparable. And he worked for the water district, sort of a working-class kid, you know, and he bought a home. And he didn't want me to park during the strike. I would go see him. He didn't want me to park my car in front of his house. He was embarrassed about it, but he was afraid, you know, that people would figure out whose car it was and that he'd be in trouble. And it was like this fear, so thick you could just cut it. And all the Protestant churches shuttered up their doors. They just, I remember how rejected the people were, and how we had a march once from Coachella to the border. And when we were marching along the Salton Sea, and it was June or so, and it was about 110 degrees. And as we would get within about 100 yards of stores, they would close all their doors and lock them up so that people couldn't buy cold drinks. I mean, if they could have enforced apartheid, they would have enforced it. It's just that, that attitude about the union. Pete Velasco didn't figure that much. There's a document that I helped Caesar write someplace, which it's called something about the church, Catholic Church, and its future or something. It was a paper that was read in Stockton at some association, some meeting. You know what that is? It got reprinted and reprinted and reprinted because it had Caesar's name on it.
Okay, what's it called again? Something like...
It was the Future of the Catholic Church and workers' movements or something like that. And this was probably around 67 or something. In which Caesar was predicting that the church, if it was to survive these turbulent times, would eventually come to see its strength was among Hispanics and the working people. And you know, it was kind of a prophetic document, because now if you know about the only voice that has any power in America speaking out about things in Nicaragua or Salvador is, you know, the American Catholic bishops. And the bottom line of the letter was that before you know it, there's even going to be a Mexican bishop. Now they're all over the place. We were just sort of agitating for a Mexican bishop. That was the whole purpose of the letter. We Mexicans deserve our own bishop. Which I think turned out to be a bummer. Who was that, Arzubi?
Yeah, Arzubi is still in LA.